So this evening, I'd like to give a talk that perhaps could be called Right Understanding. But it's going to be a kind of a reworking or reformulation of Right Understanding, Right View. And Right View, Right Understanding, is the beginning of the Eightfold Path. When the Buddha described a path of practice, he started there with the Right View or Right Understanding. And it's there, right there at the beginning of Buddhism. And in a sense, all of Buddhism kind of arises from right understanding. And it's something that hopefully we have in common. All the different schools of Buddhism, all the different practitioners of Buddhism have right understanding in common. It's fundamental in this very simple way that the Buddha offered it. And the way that I'd like to present the notion of right understanding is through a simple statement that the path or the means of practice should reflect the goal. Now the goal of Buddhist practice could be described in different ways. There's different aspects to it. But one aspect of the goal is that it's to become peaceful, to attain some deep abiding sense of peace, to be at peace in this world that we live in. And so for the means to reflect the goal is somehow there has to be peacefulness, peace, in the practice, manifested in the practice. The practice itself should be peaceful. So in another formulation that some people have used outside of Buddhism even, if you want peace, be peaceful. If you want kindness, be kind. If you want compassion, be compassionate. If you want joy, be joyful. If you want peace, be peaceful. So peace, compassion, joy are all kind of the inner way in which the goal of practice is experienced for someone who attains the goal. Subjectively, it's marked by these qualities of peace, of compassion, of love, of joy, of happiness. And so the path to practice should reflect that. Now, that took me a long time to realize, to understand, and many people. And so there can be ways in which the way that people practice can not be reflecting or expressing those qualities. So, for example, there have been times in my practice where I strived really hard. I kind of was greedy for, there was kind of a greed for some kind of attainment, some kind of result, something. Or there was some kind of aversion to some experience I was having. I might get a bit of that, push that away, not to have that, not have that kind of experience. And the presence of greed or aversion or delusion does not reflect the goal. The goal, one of the ways the Buddha described the goal of practice is to reach a place where the mind is free of greed, hate, and delusion. So to practice, for example, with the breath, focusing on the breath, being mindful of the breath, as we focus on the breath, is there greed or aversion in the way, the attitude we have, and how we relate to the breath, or how we relate to that attempt to be with the breath? So no matter what your practice might be, it could be your practice is breath meditation. It could be your practice is loving kindness. It could be chanting a mantra or some, there's all kinds of, visualization. Your practice could be right speech. Your practice could be washing dishes. Your practice can be at work. Your activity, almost any activity you do that you want to incorporate or make practice, make it into a part of the path of practice. Is it reflecting the goal? Is there some quality or relationship to it? In our relationship to it, we have the absence of greed, the absence of hate, or there's some feeling of peace, being at peace, at ease with what is there. It doesn't mean that you have to be peaceful in some conventional way. It means that the way you relate to your conflict, your aggression, your tension that you have with something is that you're at peace or relaxed a little bit about that aggression. It means that it doesn't have to mean you have not be filled with greed. Greed happens. But how do you relate to that greed? Because some things are really hard to stop doing. It's sometimes hard just in a moment's notice to decide to be peaceful in some usual conventional way. It's hard in a moment's notice to decide, you know, to let go of greed and hate. But your relationship to those things, maybe you have a little more choice around that. And that's a lot of what, you know, this foundation of practice is finding out how are we in relationship to anything? How are we in relationship to things? How are we in relationship to our greed, our hate and delusion? How are we in relationship to our self-preoccupation? How are we in relationship to the path of practice? How are we in relationship to anything we do, washing dishes or doing our work, whatever it is? And perhaps there's more choice there. And the path of practice, one of the ways to relate to practice is we're content with the small steps of what we can do. And so as we engage in whatever we're doing, so engaging with breath meditation, maybe you're quite agitated. Maybe it's very hard to be with the breath. But can there be some, even just a little hint of some peace, some ease, some acceptance, some non-conflict, some non-greed, some non-hate? Can there be some of that, or some compassion, some love in relationship to that? Maybe at first it can be a glimmer. But whatever you have choice to bring up, you bring that up so it has that quality there. And then from that quality, then something can grow. It's like that quality, a little glimmer of something, perhaps is a little seed that we've discovered or we plant. And then as we continue doing the practice, that's not the end of practice, to have just a little bit of glimmer of acceptance and peace. The hope is to be able to expand that and somehow be completely changed. But then can we slowly, so that little seed then can grow and grow and grow and develop and become something much bigger. Also, your practice, whatever you do, can begin being perhaps have some quality of enjoyment, something you enjoy doing. If you're striving and pushing and demanding for something to happen in your practice, then chances are you're not enjoying your practice. Chances are that you're destroying something within yourself rather than nourishing something and setting something free. So to So my idea is that this kind of notion that the goal should be reflected in the means, there's a built-in safety mechanism in Dharma practice. You're not going to get in trouble if that's the case. You're not going to kind of bury yourself in excessive zeal or aversion or conceit or self-deprecation or the variety of problems that can arise when you relate to yourself and you relate to the activities of the world. And in fact, as you keep this principle in mind, to look for the goal and the means, to manifest some quality of the goal and the means, it's a protection from going awry, from making the practice something which is arduous or unenjoyable. It doesn't mean that sometimes practice isn't very difficult, but there can be some kind of joy there. Perhaps if there's no joy in your practice, maybe, I don't know how much you can actually do, how many seeds you could actually water and grow and develop. When Lou Richmond, who's a Zen teacher here in the Bay Area, asked Suzuki Roshi, said, if I do this Zen practice, will I get enlightened? And Suzuki Roshi said, if your practice is sincere, it's almost as good. That's pretty good, huh? So I think this is another way of saying what I'm trying to say today, that if your practice is sincere, if you have qualities of how you are in relationship to your practice, it actually is very good. It's actually a wonderful thing. And but your practice has to be sincere. So again, if it's filled with conceit or striving or pushing or aversion or all these extra kind of stuff that we can add to it, then maybe it's not as good as becoming free. But if you can start having these qualities in your practice, then it's almost as good. And certainly you have the satisfaction of having an enjoyable and sincere practice that you carry with you. The fruits of that will follow you for a long time. So what this means is that a really important part of any practice you do is self-reflection, where you become self-aware or become aware of the attitude that you have about how you're practicing, the attitude you have as you practice. And this, again, for me, it was a long time coming. I practiced for years and years and years before I paid attention to the attitude I had as I did the practice. The attitude I had about the practice I was doing. So, for example, if the instructions is to stay with your breath, then I'll try to stay with my breath. And the breath seems to be the point. And because I'm focusing on the breath, I'm not noticing the attitude I have about focusing on the breath, because that's not the breath, right? So I can go along for a long time striving and pushing and demanding and judging myself negatively for not doing this breath meditation, and never notice it because that's not what I was told to pay attention to. I was told to pay attention to the breath. But a very important part for practice all along is to be able to do that backward step. We actually also look at the attitude we have. What's the attitude we hold in relationship to what we're doing? And this applies to everything. It doesn't have to apply just to Dharma practice. What's the attitude you have in relationship to it? And how we are is maybe perhaps more important than what we do in spiritual practice or Dharma practice. And so I'm actually, when I talk to people, I'm much more interested in how they are than what they do. It's nice that people find wonderful what's to do in their life. But I think notice that a lot of people here in California, or I don't know how to say this, I think there's a certain kind of neurosis in this part of the world that is manifested by the idea that there's a right what out there for you. The perfect what. The perfect thing that you're supposed to do, like the perfect career. There's a career out there that's meant for you. There's a relationship that's out there that's meant for you. The perfect relationship. There's a what out there. And life is about finding the right what. What am I supposed to do with my life? And now some people find wonderful whats. But, they're lucky. It's very nice. And some people, for whatever reason, never find the right whats. And it never occurred to them to look at the how. So they can end up end of life and be quite frustrated. There are some people who are blessed by never needing to find a what. Their life, they understand, consciously or somehow unconsciously, that what their life is about is how they are. So they maybe never have a great, illustrious career that you're proud of and you show off at parties about having. You say, what do you do? Oh, you can fill in, but I mop the floor at the local fast food restaurant. Well, that's not going to get you a lot of status at the parties. And we always often ask, what do you do? Wouldn't it be interesting if rather than we said, what do you do? We ask, how do you do it? What attitude do you have to what you do? How are you when you do what you do? So for some people, that's what they understand. That's what their life is about. And what is not so important, but how they are in relationship to what they do. And I've known people who just shine, brilliant people. Radiant people for whom how is more important than what. I know some people who are extremely poor, who I sometimes have, one person I think in particular, who lives in this area here, and so his poverty is a relative thing, but quite poor for this area here. And I think of him as the richest person I know because of how he is. That's what his life is about, how. So you might be a person who doesn't know if you're a how person or a what person. But even if you're looking for the what, Buddhist practice is much more about how. And if you can focus on the how you are, then you'll hopefully find how to be at peace and be happy and content with whatever you'd happen to find to do, whether you find the right thing, the perfect thing or not, the perfect relationship or not. You'll find some treasure, some wonderful quality of inner well-being, inner peace, inner compassion, inner love that you can carry with you regardless of what happens around you. And I think that's one of the goals of Buddhist practice is to find a kind of independence that is a certain kind of independence where that comes from having, we can say, an inner peace, inner well-being, inner security, inner fullness, inner knowing that supports us, that sustains us, that liberates us, that no matter where we go, what we do, what happens, this thing is here. So we're not looking outside of us for something that's somewhat, something, some person, some teaching, some experience that's going to make it prove us that we're okay or make everything okay for us. Another neurosis in American Buddhism is the experience neurosis. Looking for that experience which is going to do it for you. It's an experience which is going to make it just all okay. It's very simple. I like to think of Buddhist practice as being a very simple and perhaps even humble enterprise. It's not about so much about big experiences, but the beginning of it is with right understanding. And right understanding begins with a simple thing of understanding what the goal is, the qualities of the goal, and then step by step, in small little increments perhaps, studying your attitude and seeing how you can transform your attitude so that the means reflects the goal. So, now it's your turn to speak to the World Wide Web. So, if any of you have any questions or comments that you now dare to say, and part of the reason we do the mics is not only to record it, but the primary reason is that there are people here who use hearing assistance devices, so those people can hear as well the questions or comments, the protests. Yes.
My challenge when I practice sometimes, often lately, is staying awake. So I don't even have time to relate to anything except for trying to keep upright. I don't know if it's because I haven't slept for very long, slept through the night for a long time because of small children, mm-hmm. if that'll get better or if that's just the nature of some people's practice.
So, but you don't have time to relate to anything because you're sleepy. But then you ask yourself, how are you relating to your sleepiness? How are you relating to it?
Okay.
Yeah. You gave her a good thing.
I usually just catch myself dreaming, and then I realize that I'm not awake, so I just wake up.
Is it that innocent and that innocent that you just notice that you're drifting and dreaming, and it's an interesting observation, and you carry on, or? Is there discouragement or anger or
No, I'm just used to being tired.
What?
I'm very used to being tired. I have two small children.
So it's ordinary for you. So.
It is, but yeah.
So you might do walking meditation.
Oh, sure. During the 45.
Oh, yeah, you can do it here. We probably should do it out of the hall rather than up here.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're welcome. You're welcome to go out in the outer hall and to go back and forth.
Do I do that after I start getting drowsy? Do I just start that from the beginning, or do I try sitting first and then I start getting sleepy?
If it's a real common pattern for you to be sleepy, you know it's coming, just start that way. And you can sometimes if you do walking meditation, it can bring energy. And it might bring a kind of nice kind of energy that wakes you up. Then if you want to sit, you can come and sit after you've walked for a while. But you can walk the whole time. Walking meditation is a great practice. It's as valid a practice as sitting.
Thank you.
I was noticing in my meditation tonight that as I put my attention on breath and that it was as if the putting of attention would change what I was attending to. And that was really confusing to me, to have that sort of thing go back and forth.
Can you say a little bit more about why it was confusing? What was the pre-existing assumption about the practice?
I don't know if it was a pre-existing assumption. It was it was as if the noticing of it brought up the question of I don't know, it was just odd to sort of be able to see something from like different sides.
Yeah, it can be odd. Sometimes I think that I have two bodies, completely different bodies. One where there's awareness of my body, and the other when there's no mindfulness of the body. Or two minds, the mind where there's real awareness and the mind that really doesn't have much self-awareness. Or two hearts, with and without awareness. It's like, can be sometimes as different as night and day. And sometimes you can kind of turn it on, on and off, or it gets turned on and off. What is occurring to me is one example that I sometimes mention here of a time when I had a splitting headache driving home late at night. It didn't really make sense to stop the car, but it was really hard. And I was filled with self-pity for poor Gil. And then finally, I was so miserable, and finally it occurred to me, I teach this stuff, so I finally remembered, maybe I'll try being mindful. So I started being mindful of, the pain, the head. And when I did that, then it actually lightened up. It made more space for it, it opened up, and it didn't go away. And as I brought that kind of attention to it, then there, the energy, my psychological whatever energy, was not going into the self-pity. It was going into paying attention, the investigation, and so the self-pity dropped away. And as long as I kept the mindful, and then it didn't hurt so much. As long as I kept the mindfulness there, I could, cope with it. It was actually quite fine. I didn't mind. But then because I didn't mind so much, then my mindfulness would wane. And when my mindfulness waned, then the self-pity and the pain and the contractions came up again. And it was quite dramatic going back and forth. It was a long enough drive that I had a number of, a little while to watch that. It's a different kind of experience. One of the things we say sometimes in mindfulness practice is to practice non-reactive awareness where you're not interfering with what's happening, what's going on. You see it clearly, what it is. And so some people have that as the pre-existing assumption, I'm not supposed to interfere. And then they get a little bit confused when they notice that awareness itself, without any intention to change anything, awareness itself changes the context enough that things begin to change. It's like an ecosystem. If you bring one new element into an ecosystem, the whole ecosystem has to readapt. And if we bring awareness into the mental ecosystem, then everything else has to adapt or change in relationship to it. And it's a healthy change. It doesn't have to be intentional. It isn't that you're trying to change anything, but awareness has a nature of changing everything.
I guess what's confusing is the notion that awareness is somehow different or separate or some creation that it exists or that I guess I'll just have to sit with this a bit more to be able to articulate.
It's a great line of exploration. So if you want to try to articulate it here, I'd love to hear more. But you want to wait? Okay, thank you. All the way in the back. Blake.
Gil, if the ultimate goal of your practice is to be free from suffering, how might that freedom manifest in your daily practice?
Well, maybe it's useful to start in small ways, but Buddhism is this great world religion that talks about attaining freedom from suffering, and some people suffer more because they've encountered Buddhism than they hadn't encountered it. So that's rather unfortunate. It's kind of ironic, and one of the ways to suffer more is by how we relate to the practice. So, oh, I'm not good enough, I can't do this, I can't get concentrated, or we have certain expectations or judgments, or we grasp onto it really tight and cling to the practice, in a way. So there are many ways we can relate to it where there's suffering as part of it. To not suffer in relationship to the practice is to learn to let go or not bring those elements into our practice itself. So that at least in our encounter with Buddhist practice, we're not going to suffer more. It's actually what's trying to do it so we can suffer less. So that's one place to begin, is to look at your attitude or your approach to how you practice. And is there an attitude in the way you practice that you're going to suffer extra because of that practice, in the ways I talked about. That's one beginning. Another way is that aside from your relationship to practice, as you begin noticing what is going on for you moment by moment, you might notice that there are ways in which you are resisting or holding or judging or expecting or maybe you can begin lightening up around. And if you can't lighten up and let go of it, maybe you can stop believing them and maybe hold it in some more spacious way. Does that make sense for you?
Yes.
Is it helpful?
Yes.
Yes? Okay. Thank you.
That was very helpful what you said on the difference between what and how. I have a talk coming up with a colleague where our relating causes some resistance in me, and I was the whole time thinking, what do I say? And then when you said, look more at the how, that changes the whole pressure of having a result coming out, but more setting the flavor and the intention for the whole interaction, for the whole communication.
Beautiful. Yeah, so there you can be in intense conflict with someone, real conflict, disagreements about someone, but if you focus on how you are with them rather than the outcome or the what's supposed to happen, then perhaps you can be happily in conflict for a long time. as good friends, you can agree to disagree. I don't know your situation, but I'm just affirming what you said.
How I'm in this conflict.
Yeah. And, so, for example, one thing I've learned is that often in conflict, one of the hows that are really useful is listening to the other person well. And if the person seems really listened to and heard, that can make a huge difference in resolving the difficulty. And, being a listener, I put in the category of how, rather than some outcome of what's supposed to happen. And then you listen. And
yeah. Whereas, as I discovered, the what is focused on the result.
Right.
And that puts pressure.
And also this teaching that you put the goal should be reflected in the means. You know, it has both qualities of the result, at least of practice, but you're not waiting for the result that's far in the future. You're finding the result that can be found here and now. The how. Smita.
Is that on? That's on. Okay. I've noticed that there are times when I think I'm letting go of something, and then I kind of discover later that I've been very cleverly pushing it away.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm wondering how one discerns whether they're letting go or simply pushing something away.
Well, you did it. So how did you do it so far?
How did I?
You said you just did it. You said it took a while. You realized it later. But realizing it later that you were pushing rather than letting go, how did you realize it later? What was the evidence?
I guess partly because it kept coming back. and there seemed to be a difference in the quality of the feeling between letting go, which I assume is a more peaceful kind of experience than pushing something away or avoiding it.
Beautiful.
So
yes.
So I don't know if that's...
It's beautiful. I think I couldn't have said it better. So one of the things we do in mindfulness practice is to look at the quality of how we are. You know, how our body feels, how our feelings feel, how, you know, our mind feels. And if you're sensitive, you can feel the difference. You can feel that in genuine letting go, there's an ease, there's a lightness, and there's hopefully is a sense of joy. And if it's pushing away, those good qualities are not going to be there. And I learned this the hard way. There were times when I thought I was successfully letting go of something, but there was a kind of very low grade kind of, well, there was kind of a neutral feeling. And what I learned is that if there's no joy in the letting go, I probably haven't let go really. So there's another test, litmus test, is there some quality of joy in the letting go?
Somewhat of a related question would be, if you're, let's say that you're clinging to something, and you find that you are having great difficulty letting go of this thing, is that, at what point do you avoid the thing as opposed to facing it and trying to let go?
Oh, I see. You know, it's kind of abstract, your question. It's a good question. It's a little bit abstract, so it's hard to know what to say. But one thing is that if someone's getting harmed, then sometimes it's better to avoid it. That's one possibility, if you know someone's actually getting harmed, you or someone else. Sometimes by hanging in there with something we can't let go of and you keep doing this behavior or whatever, and it's just making things worse, then maybe you should avoid the avoid it for the time being. So certainly there are times when it's very healthy to just kind of step away and avoid something. However, there also it's important to look at the inner quality, the intention, for example. You can ask the same similar question to what you started off with. The question can be, when am I avoiding something in a healthy way, and when is it in a form of aversion? You know, I hate pushing away. That's also kind of pushing away. And so, this, again, if you're sensitive, you probably get the evidence very quickly. So behind you in the back row there.
I just wanted to say something that you have said before and that nobody else has mentioned here. So is that luckily this is a self-correcting practice. So if you come with no notion of what real freedom is or what real letting go is and what real ease and kindness to yourself is, then just you keep doing it and it will happen to you, and then you will know how to do it. Mm-hmm. This is sort of I forget the word, but it's sort of encouraging people to keep doing it, and the other side of it, not worrying so much about how you're doing it, but keep doing it, and then it will just open up. I'm sure that's some part of what happened to you. You said for a long time I struggled. And then what happened? How did you know that you could hold it lightly?
For me?
Yeah.
So I think what you're saying is very important. It's a wonderful addition to what I've said. Because I could imagine people being oppressed by what I said. Now I have to figure out how to be. There's a right how, and I don't quite understand what he's talking about, but the how seems to be really important, and I better do some kind of mental gymnastics and get myself into the right how. And it was a lot easier when it was just a what. So if it doesn't make sense what I'm saying, then what she said is that the practice is self-correcting. Just be content with the what. Just do the practice. And if the practice is paying attention to what's going on, then it's self-correcting. Sooner or later, if you're paying attention, you'll get the evidence, you'll get the information that you need to learn that something is awry, something is off, something needs to be learned or changed or shifted so you can correct. If your practice doesn't involve self-awareness as part of it, awareness as part of it, then maybe it's not self-correcting. So I've known people who've done meditation practices where they weren't paying attention to themselves very much. And so, for example, in the Zen tradition, sometimes a tremendous dedication to concentrating on the breath or just being present in some kind of abstract way. And they feel all this pain in their leg, sitting there hour after hour. And so they ignore the pain and just focus on the breath, ignore the pain, focus on the breath. And eventually they need knee surgery. And it happens sometimes in Vipassana that people end up with the knee problems. But it doesn't happen as much as in Zen, because in Vipassana we put much more emphasis on a very expansive awareness practice that is aware of everything that's going on at the same time. So you take in, if you feel pain in your knee, you bring that into your awareness and you can get that information and use it to correct. So it wasn't really answering your question directly, but maybe it's enough for now.
Why can't we all know how it was that you got to know that you were not looking at it, at your practice in an expansive way? What happened that you became aware? Was there a time that you can say something happened and I became aware?
It happened in so many small steps, increments along the way, in so many different times. I mean, some of these lessons have to be relearned over and over again. I mean, it's kind of embarrassing how many times we have to learn the same thing over again. I take an introductory course to meditation 2 or 3 times a year. I also at the same time giving it, but. It's very convenient, to do both at the same time. But I'm listening probably more carefully than some people out there, to find out what I need to know. And sometimes I give talks here, and sometimes the audience for my talk is me. It sounds like I'm really wise and everything. Maybe I don't know, but mostly I'm giving myself a pep talk. This is what you need to know. So it's a lot of small increments. But one of the ways is there's a lot of learning that comes from suffering. So I've learned from suffering. I've learned from having an attitude which was not helpful for me. And I took that in. I was mindful of the suffering, the pain that was part of that. And from seeing that, then I can learn from that and I can make a correction. I can lighten up. So suffering is one of the important teachers for us. Not so we can suffer better, but so that we could become free of that suffering. One more. Two more.
When I struggle with right understanding, because I'm not sure, but my opinion is that I kind of have, neurosis can sometimes serve you, or what you would call neurosis is sort of like a negative name for some for some an activity that sometimes can serve you. And so it's, I mean, it's good to be able to pay really, you know, to pay attention to details. But then sometimes with that attention, you can crush, you can sort of, you know, crush things with that, you know, dissection and stuff like that. And I mean, I've noticed that a lot of time, like one area is like in sort of interpersonal relationships, it can really foul things up if you're, you know, always trying to figure out what's going on. And but I don't know. There seems like right understanding. It's kind of sensitive. And maybe I don't know what you have to say about not letting that go out of hand, but when it could be something that's very part of your nature or something that serves you in other areas.
You said a lot of important things, so I don't know exactly where to pick up or how to tie it all together. But certainly there are times when having that certain kind of might be an unhealthy tendency or attitude, neurosis or whatever we have, can also serve us. And it doesn't mean you have to have the first opportunity, first time you see some neurotic pattern, try to get rid of it right away as you know, think it's a personal failing, you're supposed to do it, just get rid of it. Sometimes it can actually serve you. And one of the ways it's said in Buddhism, this kind of idea, there's a kind of, you know, you don't have to make too much of it, but there is a kind of simple typology in Buddhism of different personality types. And part of that simplistic typology is that there's some people who are greed types, some people who are hate types, and some people who are delusion types. Between the greed types and the hate types, it says it's better to be a hate type if you're practicing, for the purposes of practice, because the hate type has certain energy of saying no. And so you can use that energy of no, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to go that way. I'm not going to, and that ferocity can sometimes help you cut through attachments quicker than desires. So if you get to choose what kind of personality you're going to have, and you want to be a Dharma practitioner, then having a hate personality is better than desire personality. But you have to be careful because they also say that the hate personality can cause a lot more harm in the world than the desire personality type. So, you know, so if you can be careful and hold your hate carefully, you know, so it can have its purpose. So it's a little bit that idea. Now, in terms of investigation, of looking carefully what's going on, and it being a hindrance sometimes in certain kind of situations, hopefully the mindfulness is self-correcting in this way, that you're paying attention, noticing what the impact, what the effect is of your attention. If you're, you're at, this is an example, I'm remembering now. You know, I spent 8 months in Burma many years ago meditating intensely, where you're supposed to do everything really slowly, you know, like you're supposed to think about intending to lift the glass, intending to lift the hand, stretching the hand forward, feeling it, you know, and touching it, feeling it, intending to lift it up, you know, it just goes on and on, you know, it just takes you 10 minutes to drink, you know, have a sip of water. And it's kind of a nice practice in certain kind of situations and for certain times, you know, it's not something you want to universalize, but it's good. But I did it, and I was very happy doing it. And then I came back to San Francisco, and the first days I was back, I went down to Bank of America to open a checking account or something. And I got to the door, you know, lifting, going on. And I said, this is ridiculous. You know, this was a good practice to do then, but it's not that level of investigation of details, not appropriate now. So same thing with your friends. If you're doing some meticulous little dissection in what's every little nuance, what's going on in the relationship in between you, you know, you're going to lose your friend. That's not what's called for in that situation. And you'll get feedback. If you're paying attention, you get feedback. You know, your friend will say, can you stop doing that? Then, you know, some other. And then you make an adjustment and you kind of figure out how to be with your friend that's a different way. You know, so if you go to a coffee shop with a friend, and you have, you know, your lively kind of, you know, wonderful, lively, you know, conversation that's really, you know, sometimes it's good to let go of meticulous mindfulness because it's so much, so they're joyful and you're having a good time. So did my responses touch what you brought up? Close enough? So I think we should stop. If Mike, maybe you can come up and ask me afterwards, Michael. So we should run over. So the hope in giving this talk is that you enjoy yourself more. So I hope that you can enjoy yourself. Thank you.